Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Friday Show. It is April 27th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. You can find our website at reasonradionetwork.com. I am Mike Connor, and I am joined tonight by my illustrious co-host, Matt Parrott. We will be accepting call-ins in the second hour. The number is 1-855-477-2283. You can find that number on the right side of just about any page on the network website. And we also have a Skype chat. And if you want to get involved in that, it's a text-based chat. You have to have the Skype application installed. And what you do is you scroll down the right-hand side of any page on the website, and you find where it says Programs on the Friday Show, and then you click on the Skype icon, which is this little blue symbol with a white S in the middle. I want to mention, starting in the second half an hour, we will have a special guest, Tan Staffel, from the Age of Treason blog, and we'll be talking quite a bit about the Breivik case, and we'll be covering it from a slightly different angle than we did last week. So I think this is going to be a really good show. And we have a number of news articles, including some updates on the Trayvon Martin case. But with no further ado, let me welcome to the show co-host Matt Parrott.
Pleasure to be here.
So how are you doing this week, Matt?
I'm doing very well. Keeping very busy. It's been a real blur for me this week of just working. I submitted an article to the Occidental Observer that's whipped up a firestorm of comments and dove into that, and just having a good week. Just even spent a little bit of time with my family.
Quality time is always good, but I want to catch your article over at the Occidental Observer. I haven't really had time to catch my breath in the last week. I've been catching up on Post, and
It's a review of Farnham O'Reilly's novel Hyperborean Home, which I recommend.
Well, I'll definitely check that out later if you want to mention anything else about it. Other than that, we can move on to the first news item. Did you want to say any more about that? Or
no.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely read it myself later because I like your articles.
Maybe try to get him on the show. So I'll see what I can do with that.
We can talk. Well, anyway, we're always looking for guests for the show. The first article is the Sanford, the police chief of Sanford, Florida, in which the Trayvon Martin shooting occurred, has resigned as a police chief officially, a city commissioner reported. He was the one who he was the police chief during the investigation of the shooting of Trayvon Martin. And he was put on he was given a leave of absence, I think, or, you know, a temporary leave. And then now it's become permanent. And, you know, I imagine at the time that he, you know, when he made his decision to not to charge Zimmerman and to pretty much release Zimmerman, that he never expected this political furor to occur. And he's obviously completely sideswiped. I will say that Commissioner Patty Mahaney has said that he is nothing but a scapegoat and that the police department did nothing wrong. So there is some dissent in this, which is good. And I hope that this police chief lands on his feet, because and from the best information we have, and we've covered the details of this case ad nauseum, I'm not going to go into them again, but from the best information we have, it would seem that he made a reasonable decision based on the physical evidence and on the testimony of the witness and on everything that's going on in that community. And it's very clear that there's no evidence that he made a wrong decision here. And there's certainly no evidence that he made a racially motivated decision. But because of the power of the media to focus like a magnifying glass their particular narrative and impose that on the facts, and in some ways, you know, distort and sweep away the facts, there was an enormous amount of pressure put on this town and an enormous amount of vilification of this town and of this police department, along with the vilification of George Zimmerman, who's the neighborhood watch volunteer who pulled the trigger on Martin. And so I find this another indication of the harmful effects of the mass media and the sort of loaded narratives that are being forced down everyone's throat through the reputation and the way the story is covered and the inherent bias. And of course, this, you know, it goes without saying, but let's say it anyway, that the reason for the way this narrative is impressed on just about every story that can even remotely be made to be molded is because of the ownership structure of the mass media, which is predominantly Jewish. And Jews, and we have plenty of stories to back this up today, just even tonight and every week, it's the same thing. It's the Jewish bias against white America that causes this sort of narrative to be impressed on what ought to be just simply a local event that's covered and dealt with locally. And so this guy is this gentleman, Bill Lee Jr., who was the police chief of Sanford, Florida, now being forced to resign under the enormous national pressure, which is all being focused through the mass media. And it's a small example of the sort of power these people have. So, Matt, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think you summed it up beautifully. It's I was really impressed with how Sanford held its ground for so many weeks after the incident. And, you know, they knew that they didn't have a case on Zimmerman. And they basically, through Attorney General Holder and the media and all of this outside pressure, were forced to what they call knifeong Zimmerman. That's the word for it that's actually used after the Duke LaCrosse rape hoax, where the district attorney didn't have any case whatsoever and knew it. But because of the media uproar, this is kind of different because Nifong actually just overzealously hated these young white men and wanted to throw them in prison as some sort of ideological crusade. Whereas in Sanford, you really get the feeling that they held out and then they were like, finally, like, you know what, the whole world wants us to arrest this guy and give him a trial. We'll give him a trial, which is the wrong, you know, which is a mistake on their part. And I do hope they're held accountable for inappropriately arresting and giving this man, putting him through this when he's done nothing wrong. And they know that from the evidence they have. They should have stuck to their guns.
I think that the Zimmerman, if we lived in the sort of colorblind society that the conservatives believe in, if race truly didn't matter, Zimmerman would probably have grounds for civil suits, not only against the media, but probably against some groups like the Black Panther Party and whatnot, and against the special prosecutor. You know, the special prosecutor that Florida appointed to investigate this thing actually had started out her meeting with Trayvon's parents with a prayer. I mean, this is not this was not an objective investigation.
It was not. And, you know, with NBC's editing the tape with the explicit intent of inciting, inciting racial hatred, they accuse us of that. You know, if they could, they'd shut down this radio show on that charge. But when they're doing stuff like deliberately editing the audio to make it sound like this guy was some sort of white racist when he was neither white nor racist, is, you know, criminal. And, you know, they've besmirched this guy's reputation and should be held accountable for it.
Well, I think that he has the right to file a civil suit for the sort of treatment he's gotten here from this is really a miscarriage of justice, and it's really the poorest journalism I've seen in a really long time. I probably, if I racked my brain, I could come up with something that was worse. But this crucifixion of Zimmerman is truly astounding. It's really a little well, worrisome.
It's not about justice. It's about social justice, you know. Whether or not Zimmerman actually did it, there are deeper emotional and tribal truths here that require Zimmerman to be thrown in prison forever.
Well, I think that it really belies the whole idea that we're a post-racial nation, as Obama is. I want to iterate again. I said the other week with Paul Fromm, when Paul Fromm was on, we were talking about a lot of what's going to happen going forward on both these criminal charges and Zimmerman's prospects of counterfiling civil charges, which I think he ought to be able to do, is going to be the demographics of the local area. And I don't know exactly how those sugar out, but I know that from everything I'm seeing, that he is absolutely screwed if he goes in front of a black jury.
They won't even look at the evidence. They'll be thinking, you know, what will my family and community think if I declare this guy innocent?
They're entirely hive minded. They're entirely collectivist. Now, on the plus side, what often happens is that because black people don't have a lot of civic spirit, they often blow off jury duty. That's been known to happen. So that might be his saving grace. I mean, his only hope, though, is to get in front of a jury that's either all or mostly white. Otherwise, this will be a kangaroo court, because there's no way he would get a fair trial in front of a black jury. And it'll just be a rubber stamp. Another indication of this sort of the way the Jewish controlled media has really stirred black animus against whites in general through this case and through their narrative. And this happens every few years like clockwork in this country. If it isn't Trayvon Martin, it's Rodney King, or it's some other case. We see it over and over. Go ahead.
I'll let you finish your point. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to move on to the next article.
No, I want to say one more thing about this. This is actually Greg Johnson's the one who stated this when I was communicating with him recently. If George Zimmerman can't make a multiracial community work, nobody can. George Zimmerman is a rainbow man. Part black, part mestizo, mixed Spanish and Northern European heritage, adopted, but he's definitely from a rainbow background, on par with Obama himself. He invested himself deeply in his neighborhood, mentored black youths, advocated for black people against the police force, which was allegedly abusing black people in the neighborhood. He has done everything right, and still this happens. And this is just proof that it can't work. If Zimmerman can't make it work, what hope do I have of making it work? What hope do you have of making it work?
Oh, I absolutely agree. But I think that these problems are being exploited by the media to try to make this sort of to try to give a moral or a warning to white people out there, like this police chief, that if you do not support our narrative that whites are always the oppressors and blacks are always the victims, if you don't reflexively support the narrative that we're going to oppress, you're going to end up losing your career. And so I imagine that a lot of selfish cops will, and we've seen for example, the Nifong case that you mentioned just a moment ago. We see a lot of cops that are quite cynical and willing to do what they have to do to advance their career. Certainly not all cops, but there's going to be more pressure on the decent cops who want to do the right thing. They're going to end up being, not getting promotion.
But it's
very clear to me that the Jewish controlled media wants to put out this message, that this narrative, and they also want to have include an implicit warning to any whites who resist this message: you will be steamrollered, and you'll be forced to resign. And therefore, there's a lot of pressure to adopt the narrative of this. And but the other thing that's even more concerning is the amount of violence that we're seeing on the part of blacks against whites, against innocent whites, against strange whites they don't even know. Because you know, motivated specifically by the Trayvon Martin case, and we've talked about a couple of those in previous weeks, and now there's another one about the beating of a white Alabama man by a throng of blacks. This is being reported in Fox News. Terry Rawls, 44, has been arrested and was charged with first-degree assault. Rawls and victim Matthew Owens have had an ongoing feud dating back to 2009. Okay, it wasn't a strange white in this case. According to Chad Tucker, a spokesman for the Mobile County District Attorney's Office. But anyway...
He told some black kids to stop playing in the street and was assaulted with baseball bats, paint cans, and a variety of other weapons by a mob of black people. And what did they say as they were walking away from him after he was critically injured?
Now that's justice for Trayvon. So apparently in their minds there's a connection between...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're thinking in group terms. They actually know what's going on. They're already fighting the finger quote race war is already going on. We just haven't bothered to start defending ourselves yet. Oh, and are there any hate crime charges in this mobile thing? Surely this is clearly a hate crime.
Well,
it's a trick question.
Yes, it's. Well, as we've mentioned before, every time there's a racial incident or there's a crime involving a person of one race against another, if a white person attacks a black person, it's pretty much up to him to prove that he wasn't racially motivated.
Guilty until proven innocent.
Right, you're guilty until proven innocent. If you're a black person attacking a white, it's just assumed to be, well, it's not a hate crime. There's no evidence that it's a hate crime, and you're innocent until proven guilty. And it's all part of a process of intimidation. I will say though, if I were to take a quite cynical a look at it, that despite the pretty much intractable differences between blacks and whites, and there are real reasons why blacks and whites don't get along in terms of racial reality. But in a strange way, if you come to the conclusion as a white advocate that ultimately what is needed is a geographical separation of the races, the Jewish-controlled media, in a sort of a sick way, is doing some of the work for us by fanning black hatred of whites and inciting blacks to attack whites. Because although I deplore that in the short term and the personal tragedies and the murders and the rapes and the robberies and everything else that blacks bring against whites, there's plenty of statistical evidence showing that the statistical evidence shows that blacks choose their victims on racial grounds often. In a way, though, what they're doing by promoting that is they're going to eventually cause a reaction in whites. Not every white is going to be going to want to back down. They're not all going to go into flight and fright mode. Some of them are going to go into a fight mode. And, nothing drills home to people the reality of black crime like having someone in your family or yourself being beaten by a black who's enraged about something that happened in another state. Due to the propaganda narrative of the mainstream media. So in a way, looking at it quite cynically, I guess I can't complain about this.
Well, yeah, it definitely wakes people up, and it polarizes. And that's really what we need. If diversity had worked, how stupid would we be sounding right now? Affirmative action had successfully brought the blacks into the middle class, and they were all getting along in the neighborhoods, and we were out there saying, no, we still are opposed to that, Who would be listening to us? I mean, it's a trick question because I wouldn't be sitting here talking. I would be like, oh, wow, yeah, it's working. Diversity is working. Those racists don't know what they're talking about. But, you know, you can say I'm vulgar. You can say I'm mean, even though I'm not. You can say whatever you want, but you can't really say I'm wrong that often. I you know, one of the nice things about being a race realist and Jew-wise, I guess anti-Semite, whatever you want to call it, is we do happen to be pretty predictive about how things are going to turn out.
I agree. And there's another aspect of it that shows we're not crazy is, you know, a lot of times the Jews have a well-known history in the Black Civil Rights Movement. And basically they provided leadership and quite a bit of the funding of that. And you through the media putting whites on the guilt trip about how poorly blacks were treated and all that, despite the fact that they have a much better life in this continent than they do in their mother continent. But the idea put out there is that the Jews involved themselves in a civil rights movement out of a sense of their justice or their innate fairness or their superior motivations over regular white Americans who are these vicious, terrible racists. And how crazy would we sound saying something like that if it wasn't so obvious that they're doing everything in their power to promote racial disharmony at this point, because it's very clear that they have no, that they don't want racial justice or racial harmony. What they want is they want to pursue a program of ethnic hostility and intimidation against white Americans. They got Whitey on the run. They want to keep him that way. Stirring up blacks is a way of doing that. It's way of keeping people walking on eggshells on many levels, you know, as this police.
It's pathological. They hate us more than they love themselves. They can frame us as like that we're going to like turn into Nazis or something at any moment and try to throw them all into gas chambers or whatever their fevered imaginations want to dream up. But the bottom line is that they actually are willing to harm themselves or conflict with their own interests to harm us. They're willing to open the floodgates to Islamic immigration if it'll harm us. Now, obviously, that'll harm them too, but they hate us so much. And people, you know, they'll ask me, you know, why do you hate Jews? I don't hate Jews. I am just reacting to their hatred of me, and my people.
Yeah, well, you can't really make up the details of this case. You can't make up a story and promote it. You know, you just look at their own behavior, and it defies explanation. It's just extremely amazing that more people don't see this, that it's as unobvious to some people as it is. But that's what happens. You know, I cannot overstate the importance of who controls the mainstream media and the effect that has on our national dialogue and the sort of the world that people believe they live in. Unfortunately, a vast number of Americans watch entirely too much of the mainstream media, and they get too much of their information through the mainstream media. And
that number is decreasing, though.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing. I wonder what they're going to do about that in the future. I'm sure they're going to try something, but right now the internet has not been something they've been able to control, and we're going to be, you know, continuing with VOR, and we're going to continue trying to get another story out there than what's going on. But these guys are getting pretty obvious here. I wonder. It's amazing that they think they can actually get away with this. And
well, look how much they've gotten away with. Why would they think we would suddenly wake up now after decades? They don't know when to stop, and they'll keep going until they're stopped. They can't stop themselves.
We do have a few more stories. I think we're going to try to rapid fire them in the fourth quarter of the show, the fourth half an hour. We will be having Tanstoffel when we get back after this upcoming break, and we will be talking about Breivik. And I want to mention last week we talked quite a bit about, at least from my point of view, what was important to me was the way the violent incident overshadowed the message he was giving. When Tanstoffel comes on, we're going to talk a little bit about what the actual message was and a few other aspects of, and the way the media is covering it. So that's going to be very interesting. Please stay with us, folks.
Highly controversial Cybersecurity Act, known as CISPA, is now a step closer to becoming law following U.S. Congress approval. The process now heads to the Senate, where the White House has already threatened to veto the bill. It caused a storm of reaction among Internet users, accusing it of infringing on users' privacy and civil liberties. Martiz Ganachichakan reports now from Washington.
CISPA would make it legal for service providers like Google, Microsoft, Facebook to funnel private communications and other user-related information to U.S. authorities. It would provide the government with unhindered access to private correspondence of every American. And mind you, it's not just the Americans using their services. We're talking about internet users from all over the world. So that would be done in the name of cybersecurity. They called it Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Critics argue who it does protect is those providers, the likes of Microsoft, Google, and others. And they're strongly lobbying for the law because analysts say it's not like the companies are not sharing information with U.S. authorities already and your correspondence cannot be monitored. It can. But under existing laws, the companies can still be liable for sharing private information of their customers. So experts say the companies want legal protection for what they're already doing. That's what the proposed law is about. SOPA was a different story for them. Service providers heavily lobbied against it because it would hit their businesses. It would easily allow to shut down YouTube, for example. They host tons of copyrighted material. Anyway, SOPA was killed in Congress, largely because of the huge awareness campaign launched by internet service providers. But from consumers' point of view, whether it's SOPA or CISPA, it's seen as a blatant encroachment on privacy and freedoms. SOPA would have given unprecedented tools to shut down websites. CISPA would allow to effectively legalize the big brother on the web. Again, it's not as if private correspondence is not being monitored already, but with CISPA, Americans would be stripped of their last legal means to protect their privacy on the web.
Well, critics point to the fact that the act could eclipse all existing laws protecting people's privacy. Declan McCullough, a correspondent from CNET News, says it's the most alarming part of the bill.
The most controversial section of CISPA is the language that said, notwithstanding any other portion of law, companies can share it for what they want, as long as it's for what they call a cybersecurity purpose. Now, we have laws on the books like privacy laws, federal education records laws, medical records laws, laws protecting the privacy of gun owners, perhaps. All these laws exist for a reason, and so it's kind of weird to say we're just going to ignore each one of them. This becomes kind of this Uber law that trumps the other ones, a super law. And let's at least have more debate about that. The House leadership didn't even allow amendments, so no amendments were proposed to. You can smell a whiskey burning down Copperhead Road.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half an hour of this week's Friday show. We're broadcasting live from the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Find us at reasonradionetwork.com. I'm Mike Connor. I'm joined tonight by co-host Matt Parrott. And as promised, we have special guest Tan Stoffel. Tan Stoffel is a blogger who blogs at the Age of Treason blog. We'll have that URL in the show summary, and you may know him from previous appearances on the network. He's been on both Carolyn Yeager's show, The Heretics Hour, and on Robert Stark's show, The Stark Truth. Tan Stoffel, I would like to thank you for being on the show. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing real well. Thanks for having me on. I'm a fan of the Friday show.
Yeah, I'm a fan of your blog, too, and I was actually and one of the sort of ironies of having volunteered for VOR is I have so little time to spend reading your articles and Matt Parrott's, but I am a fan of your blog as well, especially after catching up on it this evening. And last week we did talk about the Breivik case, and I, you know, my focus, because I'm always thinking about what is effective and what's not effective in trying to reach new people. But so I had sort of a slant on it regarding how the violence overshadows what Breivik is actually about and perhaps other messages. And you have a different take on it, and you have lots of interesting insights on that. So why don't we just open it up by me asking, you know, what is this trial really about, in your opinion?
Well, let me say first that you're right. My attitude is pretty much that this is spilt milk. I mean, I acknowledge that we should think about what's effective and what tactics work, which tactics don't. But we're sort of faced with a situation here that's up beyond our control. It's happened, and we need to make the best of it that we can. And so in that regard, both with the original attack and with the trial now, I've focused my energy on trying to pay attention to what the media is doing, how they're trying to spin it, and who's spinning it and why. And in the initial attack, I saw some differences from the trial, but the trial is what's happening today. So I would say, you know, what this trial is about is it's much more than what it seems on the surface. That on the surface, it's a man who murdered 77 people, and he's on trial for mass murder. And it seems pretty cut and dried because he admits that he did it, and he has even gone into great detail as to how he planned it, how he planned to do it, and how he did it. He's testified in court to that. But what the media has tried to do is make this into a, you know, to put the whole spectrum of far-right politics on trial and to say this is where far-right politics leads. It leads to mass murder. And Breivik himself has defended himself, but he has not pled guilty. He's pled not guilty. And it's been reported that that was in self-defense, but that's a mistranslation, I think, and potentially even a misreporting by hostile media. What he really was pleading is the right of necessity, apparently, according to one of the commenters on my blog, who's a more of a native Norwegian speaker, understands what's going on there. And this is apparently a concept in Norwegian law that doesn't really exist in our form of law, this idea that it's okay to break the law and not be punished for it if the ends justify the means. And in Breivik's case, what he's arguing is that the policies of the government, which are supported by the media, are overshadowing any sort of democracy from being able to work. And if democracy was allowed to work, the people of Norway would not allow this mass immigration and eventual displacement and dispossession of the Norwegian people of their country. And he's written not just about Norway specifically, but he has sentiments that extend to Europe in general.
Okay, could you tell us a little bit about Breivik's ideology? How would you describe it? What are his positions? And how does this fit into what he did?
Well, there's some controversy about what it is that he believes. You know, according to the media, he's just crazy. He's kooky. And he's far right, and he's a Nazi, Jew hater, whatever. According to people within our own circles, there is a strong element of whether it's trolls or people who are really sincere who think he's some sort of Zionist tool. I can't read Breivik's mind, I can only say that based on what he's written in his manifesto, or what he calls his compendium, and what he's testified in court, he comes across to me as a heartfelt nationalist, a person who has a sense of defensiveness for his own people. He loves his own people. He wants to protect them. He wants to do what he thinks he needs to do to defend them from the people he thinks are responsible for harming them. And he comes out of something called the Counter Jihad. That's his compendium was mainly citing many people who have written who are not quite nationalists. It's sort of a related movement, but it's a perversion of nationalism. It's quite distinct from nationalism, called the Counter Jihad. It's really a Jew first, Israel first movement. And there's lots to say about the difference between nationalism and counter jihad. I'll give you an opportunity to take me whatever direction you want to go.
Well, the counter jihad movement we see in popping up in a lot of European movements, most prominently is the English Defense League, where they're and it seems like they wave Israeli flags, and also they have the pro-homosexual rainbow banner. And it seems like after that, English nationalism is kind of like a distant third priority. And so you do see I have seen this sort of evidence of the disconnect between the counter jihad movement and nationalism. But would you also say that the counter jihad movement is a gateway towards nationalism, or there is a progression? Do you sense a progression in Breivik's thinking?
I sense a progression for sure, because I'm a product of it. My patriotic instincts were misdirected into the counter jihad. I thought when I was getting kind of upset with what was going on with the invasion of Iraq, I started following people who eventually led me into the counter jihad. And I thought, that's the problem. And over time, though, I realized that they were just focused on a very narrow aspect of the problem, which is Islam and Islamification, which is a very big problem in Europe. It's certainly one of the central concerns of any European nationalist, because most of the immigrants are Muslim, or the most alienating ones culturally. And also because the counter jihad they are semi-respectable. They're the people who are involved with it get published by mainstream outlets. And so their concerns actually touch on or reach into mainstream politics and mainstream media, and get expressed, their fear of Islamification of Europe. But what you eventually realize if you are a true nationalist or have true nationalist instincts, is that these people do subordinate white interests to Jewish interests. I mean, they talk very, very passionately about defending Jews and defending Israel. But if you express a similar passion for white people, Norwegians, Brits, Europeans in general, whites in general, they look at you askance if you start saying things a little bit too strenuous, or if you start to question Jews, for instance, then they eject you, they excommunicate you from the counter jihad. And I went through all of this, to calls of Nazi and anti-Semite and whatever. They're very liberal. Basically, just want to focus on the defense of Jews and what's good for the Jews and a defense of Israel. But they do it in a kind of sneaky way. They're not really upfront about that. What they put up front is nationalistic imagery, and they pay lip service to nationalistic view of history. Heroic defense of Europe against the Muslim invasion by Charles Martel and at the gates of Vienna. And this obviously lit up Breivik in the same way it did me, in the same way it has many hundreds of white nationalists or eventual white nationalists. And I see Breivik, I think, was making the trajectory toward a true white nationalism. What he's expressed in court is Norwegian nationalism and the European nationalism in general.
Well, to give you another example of a counter jihadist, you have Geert Wilders in Holland, and I looked at him and studied him a little bit, and I don't see any evidence that he's progressed anywhere near nationalism. He seems to be against Islam because it tends to be against modernism and liberalism. But I think that I take that you're saying Breivik has gone farther than Geert Wilders in becoming a true nationalist, but he hasn't gone so far as to take a critical position on the Jews. Could you describe for us what Breivik, I'm calling him Breivik, I think you call him Breivik, I don't know really how to pronounce it, by the way, but what do you think is Breivik's position on the Jews, and why do you think he's failed to progress as far as maybe he should have?
I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Breivik. I was wondering myself, and I went and searched for it and put a comment on my second to last blog about it, and a commenter there confirmed that that's their idea too in Norway as to how to pronounce it. So it's Breivik.
Okay.
The Jewish the accusation from a certain quarter on our side is that he's some kind of Zionist and some kind of Jew lover, puts Jewish interests first, and I think that there's not much evidence of that. If you read his compendium, he mentions Jews, and he says that he supports Israel, he supports the right of Jews to have a nation for themselves. There's probably some other arguments in there. He's certainly anti-Nazi in his rhetoric. But again, this is sort of normal for European nationalists these days, given the history of World War II and the lesson that they've been indoctrinated to take away from it, is that trying to do away with your Jews, to take control of your country back from Jews, as the Germans did, gets you nothing but misery and destruction. And so, therefore, you must not do that. And these counter-jihadists especially basically blame the Nazis for making nationalism a toxic thing. And so rather than blaming the Jews who are making it toxic actively to this day, they go back 70 years and blame the Nazis because, of course, you can blame white people and Nazis for anything, and you can't blame the Jews. So I think Breivik has there's nothing nefarious going on there. There's plenty of white nationalists who say, hey, you know, I'm a nationalist in general, and so everybody should have their nationalism, and I don't have any problem with that. He was probably even a little bit blind to Jewish influence, although some people, some Jews, have written articles about, he talks a lot about cultural Marxism and Frankfurt School, and how could you do that without knowing about the Jews? He must secretly know that it's all about the Jews. But I think there are pro-white people who imbibe all of that stuff, and especially the stuff that doesn't mention that the people involved are Jews, or mostly Jews, and never see that angle to it. But they do think that it's a bad thing. And
For somebody who had the lack of tact to kill an island full of children, it's my opinion that he puts an awful lot of thought into selling the message. I mean, you know, the guy is obviously very big on image, both projecting his personal image in his infamous YouTube video, in the trial right now, which he foretold. So I think it's difficult to ferret out exactly what his real sentiments are, because, you know, he may very well be taking his position on the Jewish question after deciding that it's tangential or unwinnable. I definitely agree that he does not fit quite the profile of the Geert Wilder style counter jihadist. He's definitely more over to the straight nationalist, while seemingly between those two worlds, in my opinion.
And possibly even trying to discredit the counter jihad in favor of nationalism. But I, you know, that takes, you have to step into his head and read his mind to know, did he plan this? Was he aware of the Jews? And he's just pretending he doesn't because he thinks that's a bad idea. His manifesto is filled with plotting and deception, you know, his evaluation of the chances of this and the chances of that. So he's obviously an intelligent guy, and he might have done that calculation. That if he, in fact, the commenter who described him as having this anti-Nazi stand and not necessarily being a Jew lover, and saying that this was normal for European politics, I forgot where I was going with that.
That's okay. I wanted to interject anyway. You know, with Geert Wilders, to just to draw him as a comparison, as a counter-jihadist who's clearly a philo-Semite. I mean, very clearly he's gone, made pilgrimages to Israel and prostrated himself and whatnot. Is Breivik a philo-Semite, or is he somebody who's just merely kind of neutral on the question? Or
I think he's neutral and maybe leans toward liking them. I think you can't think for very long in nationalist terms and not realize that the Jews aren't your people, unless you're a Jew. You know, the first question of nationalism is, who are we? And then the second question is, what's best for us? And the first question, you might pretend that Jews are your people, part of your people, and certainly Jews want you to think that. But you eventually figure out that what's best for us, there's a whole lot of Jews attacking us, eroding our sense of who is us and attacking us outright. So it doesn't last for very long.
Right. I agree completely. I will add that Jews kind of get with their mother's milk a sense of identity, which is distinct from anybody other group. And so it's kind of moot whether we consider them white or not. You know, they're obviously a subgroup of the greater Caucasoid branch of humanity. But white people who are first entering nationalism may not put a big, amount of weight on being Jewish or not, because they might identify Jews as being Caucasoid and may not know that Jews are not just simply another religion. So, one of our tasks in our little corner of the blogosphere is to point these issues out and try to explain. And really, it's undeniable. I mean, Jews just so much identify with their own group against any other group. And also, there's quite a history of ethnic hostility from Jews against whites that, you know, it's absolutely impossible to incorporate, you know, the Jewish people as a whole into any sort of white nation, whether it's America or Europe.
White Americans, as opposed to white Europeans, are very muddled on identity and tribal identity, what it means to belong to an ethnic people. That's more intuitively obvious to a Norwegian, where because of our history and because of the propaganda, even a lot of people who consider themselves white nationalists don't really have a clear understanding of what it means to belong to an ethnic people, a nation.
Well, that's an unfortunate thing. Of course, I've made the argument before that America was an ethnic nation. They just happened to expand itself into a much, incorporate large numbers of European immigrants. I think that by losing control of the mass media in the 20th century, a lot of that was what little we had. There might have been less than a typical European nationality in America, even from the get-go, due to the earlier roots and whatnot. But I don't think that was necessarily had to happen the way it did. I think it's recoverable today. That's, of course, my personal opinion. I know other people differ on that. But if I can get back to Breivik for a moment, because I want to ask a couple more questions of Tanstoffel. He's claimed self-defense as his reasons for not being guilty, given all the slaughter. And that comes across the way it's been translated or the way it's reported in the Anglosphere as kind of being a crazy defense. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works in Norwegian and how that's been translated and whether it's really crazy to claim that?
Well, I can't, but I can speak to this point about craziness, and that's been really the excuse all along. And not just for Breivik, but before Breivik, and it will be long after Breivik. The basic argument against any nationalist is, based on the Jewish narrative, and this is a Jewish line of attack, is you're stupid, you're crazy, or you're evil. And in the case of Breivik, it's pretty obvious he's not stupid. It was a pretty involved attack, required a lot of planning. And even that, their first line of attack on him, or their first way of seeing him, portraying him as crazy, didn't hold for the same reason, that it's eventually it's come out that he's all there. I mean, he's not crazy. He made some very elaborate plans and has some good rationale behind it. And that's it drove the media crazy for the first week of his trial that he was able to present because of his defense that he was not guilty, his claim that he was not guilty. He was able to present his rationale for why he committed this attack. And the media had all sorts of side stories that maybe weren't read by as many people as their upfront reporting, but they were going through a moral dilemma. They knew that this is the enemy, and they didn't want the enemy to be able to get his message out through their media. Normally, they clamp down. And that's exactly what Breivik, that's one of the points he's been making all along, is the media has been unfair and biased, and they are squelching democracy. You know, I think he's given up on democracy. That's pretty clear, as many of us have. But he was just trying to hold them to their own values, and he's been using their terms and their way of reasoning. He's talked about indigenous people, and he's described the Norwegian people as indigenous people. And these people in the media are, you know, generally their liberalism is all about protecting the rights of indigenous people and in favor of people like that, in favor of the weak over the strong. And it's Breivik is really calling attention to the fact that it's a big fat lie, that this idea that there's two ideas behind liberalism. One is that we're all equal, we're all the same, and therefore, you know, we should have all these people come into our countries, and because we have no argument against it, because that would be racism, and racism is bad. And then the second principle, which is more coming from the Jewish narrative, and it's rising because Jewish power is rising, and that part of it is, you know, white people are bad. There is a difference in race, that race is important. White people are bad. They're victimizers. They're oppressors. And non-white people, including the Jews were the template for all of this, are innocent victims. And they're good people, just looking for a better life for themselves and their family. They can't do any wrong. Even when they kill people, like in what happened in France just a week or two before this Breivik trial came up. That fella, you know, they talked about it, but was out of the headlines as soon as they could. Oh, okay, he's dead. And no need to talk about immigration anymore. They were ready to blame people who are the far right, who are against immigration, and they're willing to tag any violence onto them, hanging around their necks. But what they won't do, and this is what we need to make an issue out of it, is the far larger damage that's done by these open borders and forced integration policies that these liberals, these Marxists, the cultural Marxists, support unabashedly and is leading to far more suffering, more rape, robbery, and murder than anything that Breivik did. And that they need to be held accountable to that. They need to defend themselves from the insanity that they're creating. They have the power in this society, and they need to be held accountable to what they're doing.
Dan, let me sneak in one more question regarding Breivik's insanity or alleged insanity. He claimed apparently to be part of a secret underground group that was modeled after the Knights Templar in defense of Western civilization. Is there any evidence for this claim, and is it any sort of indication that he may be suffering from some form of delusions of grandeur or something?
That could be. That's probably the most reasonable accusation against him, because I don't buy it myself that there's some Knights Templar that he's organization he's part of. But he's made the point, two points in court. One is that he said in his compendium he never said it was a big organization, as the media seems to want to paint it as. Delusions of grandeur usually involve having lots of people involved. The counter-jihad in general has those delusions of grandeur, that they're on some heroic fight to save all of Europe. And that's, I guess, what attracts patriots is this fight against the odds, you know, us versus them. It's an inspiring thing, and not just for Breivik, but for nationalists in general.
Well, I think he was trying to motivate, create that, to inspire people. I don't think it's taken off as he had hoped, But that totally makes sense to me that he would plug that in with everything else to be like, you know, and if you want to be a Knights Templar like me, you can be. And it's a distributed Al-Qaeda style framework. So just hop on board and, you know.
Well, folks, that's our break. Stay with us. We'll be back with more of our interview with Hans Stoffel.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff with the Week in Review. Rupert Murdoch has apologized again for phone hacking at the News of the World, and he said he failed over the matter. Our correspondent in London, Ollie Barrett, reports.
Rupert Murdoch told the Leveson Inquiry he believed he and other senior executives were shielded from the extent of the illegal activity taking place at the News of the World, the paper he had to close when the scale of the practice of phone hacking there was revealed.
Someone took charge of a cover-up, which we were victim to, and I regret.
The 81-year-old also said he was shocked to hear the publisher of his British newspapers, News International, had not initially cooperated with the police investigation into phone hacking, and he insisted he and his executives had had no inappropriate contacts with government when his News Corp was trying to buy the entirety of broadcaster B Sky B, an issue that has Britain's Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt currently fighting for his career. And at the end of Mr. Murdoch's 7 hours of evidence, he warned against an over-regulation of a press already struggling in the online age. Ollie Barrett, London.
Liberia's former president, Charles Taylor, was found guilty of aiding and abetting the Revolutionary United Front rebels in Sierra Leone during their reign of terror. Our correspondent, Nina Maria Potts, was at The Hague for the verdict.
Charles Taylor has been found criminally responsible for aiding and abetting war crimes and crimes against humanity during the decade-long war in Sierra Leone. That's the verdict from the UN Special War Crimes Tribunal for Sierra Leone at The Hague, where a three-judge panel delivered a highly complex ruling in which not every charge levelled against Liberia's ex-president stood up under scrutiny. Charles Taylor himself remained somber throughout the proceedings with little hint of emotion, and if he appeals, that could take several months.
Needham Reports at The Hague.
At the end of the week, nearly a dozen were killed in Damascus by a bombing and many more injured. Kofi Annan, the UN and Arab League envoy to Syria, is urging the rapid deployment of up to 300 ceasefire observers. His spokesman, Ahmed Fazi, says the latest violence proves the need to reinforce the international monitoring mission.
We have used all the words in the dictionary. It's fragile, it's shaky, it's precarious, it's risky. But it's all we have at the moment, and it underscores the need to deploy our monitors as quickly as possible.
Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, declared victory in the race to be the Republican Party's presidential nominee.
I can say with confidence and gratitude that you have given me a great honor and solemn responsibility. And together, we are going to win on November 6th.
Coming up, Newt Gingrich is expected to finally, formally suspend his campaign to be the Republican nominee. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second hour of this week's Friday show. It is April 27th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Find us at reasonradionetwork.com. I'm Mike Connor. I'm joined tonight by co-host Matt Parrott and special guest Hans Toffel. We've been talking about the Breivik court trial and discussing that. We will be accepting call-ins. If you have a question for Hans Toffel, feel free to call in at 1-855-477-2283. That's a toll-free number. Picking up where we left off, I want to talk a little bit now about what Hans Toffel calls the enemy media. I think that's a great phrase, and I think it encapsulates what we actually have in our Western world. It is an enemy media. And, Tan, you have a particular post on your blog that lists a bunch of tweets, but apparently a bunch of journalists that are in the courtroom, and they're using Twitter from the courtroom. Why did you write that post, and what do you think it reveals about the enemy media?
Well, it reveals first and foremost that they're the enemy, and not just to people like us who are already aware of that, but to whites in general, I think, Westerners in general, that the media's disdainful view toward us, anybody actually who has views that are counter to their own, is as an enemy. They view us as the enemy. So they're kind of sneaky about it. They're kind of dishonest about it. And I think people sense that. People aren't as stupid as everybody assumes that they are. They're mostly just distracted and paying attention to other things. But when they do pay attention to the Breivik thing, and the media has picked up on this, the general public is actually a large segment of people are supportive of Breivik, or at least his views, maybe not what he did. But what scares the media is that their reporting, and especially the Twitter-type reporting that was pretty much cut and dried what he was saying and what was going on in the courtroom at the time, especially in the early part of the trial, disturbed the media, and that's what caused their moral dilemma, that they were not able to contextualize, which to them, that's their dishonest language for being able to repeat over and over again that he's a far-right extremist who's murdered 77 people for no good reason whatsoever because he's crazy. You know, just repeating that line over and over with, you know, a few facts of the day dropped in between that. That's what they want to do, and that's what they've gone back to doing now by, you know, killing off the Twitterers. But even the Twitterers were enemies and reported only what they thought would help, you know, prove that Breivik was such an insane and ruthless guy, and many times saying things like Breivik showing no emotion, whereas there were other times that other people were reporting, and this is where listening to many of them makes you're able to get a better picture by listening to more of them, is even if one of them decided to omit certain details, like when Breivik was crying during his own watching his own video, somebody else will report it, and then they have to explain it. Well, why was he crying? Because he cares for his people, and he's upset about his people. And it's come out in his testimony, too, which they had to report, that he felt forced to do this, that he didn't want to do this, that if the media wasn't so biased against nationalism, that he wouldn't have done it. And there were some people on the island, even in their gruesome reporting of the facts of the attack itself, that he passed over and didn't kill. And he said he didn't realize that there would be so many younger folk there. I think, assumed that there would be a lot more leaders there. And a lot of the leaders got away. In fact, the adult leadership that were on the island.
You mentioned during the break that you were at an article over at Counterpunch written by Jeff Sparrow. What do you want to tell us about that article, and what do you think about it?
Well, I want to call attention to this because of all the articles I've run into so far during the trial. This, I think, really drives home the point that these are the enemy, the media, and why they're the enemy, and what's the thinking in their heads about it. And Jeff Sparrow, in the article titled "Dealing with the Real Anders Breivik," he went to a counter-jihad site. I'm pretty sure it was Jihad Watch, Robert Spencer's site, because Robert Spencer is cited several times in the compendium. And he quoted a commenter there writing, Anders Breivik should not be on trial. Islam should be on trial. And the verdict, guilty. And he cited this because he wanted to scaremonger about it. He wanted to say, look, this is what these people think. And so then he writes, this is him talking now, Jeff Sparrow. In that discussion, we see the terrifying potential for Breivik to emerge as the John Brown of counter-jihad, fanatical, excessive, and violent, yet lauded as a hero, willing to put principles into action. After Hitler's defeat, the invocation of the Holocaust helped marginalize would-be Führers for decades as anti-racists said loudly, we've seen your ideas before, and they left 6 million dead. That was a quoting supposed anti-racist. Then he goes on to say, the tragedy in Norway provides a similar opportunity to isolate a new crop of bigots and hate mongers. Those who mutter about civil war against multiculturalists and Muslims should be confronted again and again with Utøya, the island, the name of the island they attack on, for it's where their rhetoric leads. And I would say we need to face this kind of sentiment head on. And the way we face it is we say, these people who say these things, these self-righteous anti-racists, need to be confronted with the results of where their rhetoric leads. And where their rhetoric leads is to Oslo being majority non-Norwegian, as Breivik's trial has called attention to, as Breivik has, while all the counter-jihadists are scrambling away to distance themselves from him, he stood up and made that point in court and drove it home. And you won't find that debated in our media because the media is biased and against us and is anti-white. You can see it going on in London and the controversy when John Cleese talked about how London is no longer an English city. And you can see it in Paris and you can see it in Los Angeles. You can see it in all the major cities in the Western world, the white world. And you'll eventually see it in the countryside, too. What you're seeing is the ethnic cleansing of indigenous white populations. That is who we're up against, people who want to do that and who will justify it by calling us names, by saying that we're Nazis. And I want to call attention, too, here to the Jewish narrative that's behind this thinking in these people's minds. They are thinking about Hitler being the worst person ever in the world and the 6 million dead from World War II. 6 million. A lot more than 6 million people died during World War II, but according to this guy and according to people who have the Jewish narrative going in their head, it's only the Jews who matter. So that's where they get their self-righteous attitude from, this Jewish narrative. And this is the danger Ermin Vinson writes about in his book on Hitler, that this is the danger of thinking about history and morals from another person's point of view, another group's point of view. When you put the Jewish what's good for the Jews into your head and run that program, you get rhetoric like this from Jeff Sparrow, that nationalists who are just trying to defend themselves against these genocidal maniacs who want to see their countries destroyed, they're acting like they're the self-righteous ones because they're against 77 people being murdered. Thousands of people have been murdered by Muslim immigrants and non-Muslim immigrants, immigrants, period. And they're just genocidal. I won't say that they're crazy because I don't think that they are crazy. That's a cop-out. To call your enemy crazy is a cop-out. It's basically saying that you don't understand or don't want to confront what it is that they believe.
Well, I was going to actually ask you that if you've thought at the end whether he was crazy or not. I don't see any evidence that he's crazy. He's too meticulous and too well thought out, and he's done something that is, while you know, very brutal and something I don't approve of, it to be quite honest. I know that there's a sort of cold-blooded logic behind it, and that's not an indication of real mental illness. The closest that comes to it is that this idea that he's part of this underground network, which probably does not exist. Maybe it does exist, but probably doesn't. But yeah, I see your point about this Counterpunch article being an example of the enemy media and the way that they're using this case to continue to marginalize nationalism in Europe and try to tar the right in general, the what's usually called the far right. To me, it's just
it's uniformly called the far right. They never just say right politics; they say far right.
You know, there's so many things that can be said about the language that's used in the enemy media. You know, aside from far right, another word that you hear is extremist. You know, I have a different opinion about who's extreme. I think replacing the white nations with multicultural entities, which are on average coffee-colored and have no absolutely no roots and no sense of anything other than, you know, watching sports and being consumers, you know, I think that's what the extreme position is. I think that's what, well, some people have called it genocidal, and that's sort of a loaded term, genocide. And I'm not sure, like, it's the same as mental illness. I don't think we want to toss that word around lightly, but what's happening is sort of a soft genocide. It's done through lower demographics, through, you know, destroying the family unit. It's done through miscegenation and, you know, disparate birth rates.
I think it's holding them to their own standards. Using the word genocide is holding the liberals to their own standards. They're the ones who go on and on about genocide all the time. Even this guy here talking about the 6 million who died in World War II. He's talking about genocide. He doesn't mention the word. He doesn't mention the word Jews. But that's what he's talking about.
Well, what do you think the value is in in my opinion, our exclusion is, finger quote, far right from the political mainstream? One of the things about Breivik's biography was he tried to engage in politics and found out that the democratic process excludes him, integrally excludes him. And it puts us in this position where, you know, if I'm trying to tell somebody not to commit a violent act, not to become a radical, to engage the process, I'm essentially setting somebody up for a fool's game, for a mug's game. And I've seen this myself. We've hosted the most benign little meetings you can imagine. And you know, we get attacked. And then the local police are against us and help the thugs shut down our meeting. And it's infuriating, and it's coming out in my voice right now, but it's a terrifying, castrating feeling. To have your voice taken away from you because of your politics. And I would just challenge that, you know, you either allow us, both in America and Europe, to be part of the political process, or you attempt to silence us, you attempt to make our position illegal, and then we'll find some other way to express our political will. You can't have it both ways.
Well, we shouldn't be confused about this. It's, you know, we're in a conflict here. We're in a war, and these people are not going to be happy with us continuing to exist. And it's that simple, and that explains why they behave the way they do. They're not concerned about being hypocrites. I mean, we call it double standards, hypocrisy. You know, but and the best we can do, I suppose, is when using arguments like that, is to aim at our liberal brethren who are under the delusion that this, what we're trying to do here is create an equal society in which racism doesn't exist. And that's playing tricks on white people, you know, trusting that we can have that is the goal, to have a deracinated society or a post-racial society. It isn't, though. As I described, there's the two conflicting elements, the pretense up front, which is really springs out of classical liberalism, this idea of equality, fraternity, liberty, French Revolution type ideas. That's an old white idea. It's dying with the white people and as white people lose political control. And the second Jewish idea is coming to the fore now, and that is white people are bad. And this is based on their own telling of what it means to be a Jew. A Jew is a victimized person. They've been victimized for 2,000 years. And who have the victimizers been? White people. So white people are bad. Non-whites are good people. They're the victims. And then one is shading into the other. You know, the Jewish one is rising in prominence along with Jewish influence and power.
Well, the narrative we keep coming back to time and again, and that is that's a crucial thing. But getting back to a word that was thrown out around a bit that I think is another loaded term is the term democracy. And, you know, whether you or not you believe in democracy, I think that's a side issue of what it is and whether we really have it. It's difficult for me to say that our society is democratic, for example, in the United States, because democracy to me would tend to entail by definition, that the some by one means or another, through some sort of representative process or people directly voting, however it is, that the expressed will of the people is made into policy. And if you look at huge issues like the 1965 Immigration Act in the United States, and you look at the
We might have lost Mike. Do we still have Tam?
Oops, yeah, I'm here.
Okay, yeah, he'll be back in just a second, I'm sure. But yeah, I definitely see his point as far, you know, the democratic process is a lie. And I've seen that firsthand here in Indiana. We passed the Senate Bill 590 thing. We helped pass it. Obviously, our little group didn't cause it singularly. But and then we watched it pass against tremendous pressure from the agribusiness and La Raza crowd, and then the activist judges just topple it over at the top, and that's hugely frustrating. You know, once again, to have your voice nullified.
Well, and beyond that, it's a lie. Really, democracy is at least in the current form that it's in. It's really just a mask for plutocracy, the plutocrats, who the rich people, who actually their say is much larger than any other voters' say. They can afford to buy the media, or in some cases, own the media already. So there's a selection process as to who is able to run and what ideas are able to be discussed that is controlled. Largely controlled by them, and that plutocratic class in the Western world is largely Jewish now. It's wildly disproportionately Jewish, that's for sure. And all
right.
The rest of the
even
people,
the ones, yeah,
even the ones who aren't Jews are afraid to do anything that the Jews don't like because the Jews will smash them.
Right. Well, and I wouldn't even give them the credit of saying that they are afraid of the Jews. You know, they're clawing to get ahead relative to their friends, and they know that sucking up to the Jews and serving Jewish interests is a winner if you're trying to get ahead in politics.
Yeah. Yeah, and they see that at every level too, not just amongst the plutocrats. Who are wealthy and independent in that sense, but the people who work for other people feel it even more. They can't say anything critical of Jews or Israel without fear of losing their livelihoods. What's his name? Joe Sobrun expressed that really pithily, saying, you know, everybody has to be aware of it. Everybody is aware of Jewish power, but they're also aware that you can't say anything about it, otherwise they'll smash you. They'll kill you. Get you fired. And
exactly.
We see that every so often, every couple of months, somebody else very prominent is fired, destroyed in some way.
Right.
So I'm back. I don't know how far. Thank you very much. I have an internet connection problem, which will hopefully be solved by my impending move. But I don't know how far I got. I was going to make the point regarding a democracy, if it means anything, has to be the express will of the people. And what we have instead of a people dissolving governments when the rights or the interests of the people are being violated, we have a government dissolving the people and replacing it with another one. That was going to be my point, which I don't think I got to. But moving on with the we've only got a few minutes left in this interview. I want to go through maybe some of these other blog posts. That, like I said, I wish I had more time to enjoy the output of some of the better blogs in our little corner of the internet. But one is another example of the enemy media, and this one is by Leonard Zeskind, I would imagine it's pronounced. And it's a statement of a renewed organization for new times. Ted, can you tell us a little bit about this article? What is it about, and what does it show about the enemy media?
Well, Leonard Zeskind is not really a member of the media. He's more a member of the anti-racist crowd. He's more like a Tim Wise type figure. He's the kind of guy who illustrates how anti-racism is really anti-white. He claims to be against racism, but he spends all of his time bashing white people. And what I quoted here in his article, I'm trying to find it myself now, is pretty brutally anti-white, explicitly anti-white, and in defense of Jews. He mentions, you know, the horrible scourge of anti-Semitism probably three or four times or every other paragraph in the part that I quoted there. And he's a Jew himself, so, you know, that makes perfect sense. You know, he's doing what he thinks is in his own best interest and the best interest of his narrow group. And this is the nature of liberalism. White people go around pretending it's our job to make a good, safe society for everybody. And these minorities, and that's really an Orwellian name, because maybe in the case of Jews, they are literally a minority. But in the case of Latinos or blacks, they're not necessarily a minority, but you know, they're non-whites. They aren't white people, and they are free to organize racially for the best interests of their group. And they do it relentlessly and unapologetically while they attack white people for even coming anywhere close to doing what they do.
So you have let's talk about this one. Now, this was a great article that Greg Johnson wrote called Our Fault. And I have to say that Greg Johnson has got to be one of the most careful thinkers and best writers out there right now. And he wrote a great article called Our Fault that actually grokks with your suicide meme. Tell us what about that article and what you think about it and how it fits in with your own philosophy.
Yeah, suicide meme is one of these ideas that I have been harping on for a while. It's this I'm dissatisfied and concerned about people who present themselves as pro-white or white nationalists and then describe our problem as being suicide, that we're doing this to ourselves. And that makes me unhappy because I don't think that that's a fair description of what's going on. I think a lot of white people don't realize that there's any problem. If you read the mainstream media, the problem is, as far as they're telling people, is racists. You know, that's the problem. Racism is the problem. And it's not that white people are going extinct or that our lands are being invaded by aliens who hate us and that this is all being forced down our throat through the courts and corrupt politicians. It's only people who break that politically correct membrane and then start writing for, you know, people like us to pay attention to. And these people are blaming white people for doing all of this to ourselves. And Greg, I thought, wrote a very good article that went beyond my point. My point was relatively narrow, that this is wrong. We should call it genocide if we're going to call it anything at all. It's more correctly called genocide than suicide because there's an element of other competing peoples, in particular the Jews, who are helping this along, are taking part, an active part in it. They're not just standing idly by innocent. And Greg went into some greater depth about all of this and tried to separate what our part of it is and what the Jewish part is, and ended with what I thought was a pretty positive note as far as people like us who are aware of this, who obviously aren't suiciding ourselves, don't want our people to go away or be killed, is that we stop abiding it. That we do something actively against it. That I don't want to suggest that we all go out and do like Anders Breivik did, but you know, basically he, if anything, proves that it isn't suicide. Here's a guy, he may have been confused a bit or not seen the whole picture, that the jury's out on that as about the Jewish issue, but he at least saw that what he called cultural Marxism is a threat to his people, and he tried to do something about it. So it's not suicide. It's being imposed on us. And even the media recognizes that in their when their hair is down a little bit and they're debating amongst themselves, they think, that it disturbs them that there are so many people who oppose them. And what are we going to do about that?
Dan, we've got less than a minute, so I want to ask you one more question. We've been talking a lot about the Trayvon Martin case, and you have a blog piece called No Separation, No Peace. It was so. I love that phrase. Tell us a little bit about that and quickly your take on Trayvon Martin.
Well, Trayvon Martin was an explicit, or the Jewish narrative was very explicit there. You could see it very clearly, this idea that whites are always the bad, the villain, the victimizer, the oppressors. They were so desperate to follow.
Why no separation, no peace, though?
Well, if we don't separate ourselves from these people, we'll never be happy. And they insist, they're the ones who insist on continuing to follow us wherever we go. They want to come into our whitetopias. They see that as a threat, and they've got to move in next to us while they're calling us a racist. You know, it's let me into your country, you awful racist. It's a contradiction. And they know it is. It's just a trick.
Ken Stoffel, I want you to thank you for being on the Friday show. It's been a real blast, and I hope to have you back again sometime. I'm sure Matt.
She said, don't give me no lines and keep your hands to yourself.
Well, the Supreme Court has heard arguments in the case of Arizona's controversial immigration law. The way it plays out in Supreme Court could set the tone for immigration laws in several other states. Amid all this, we want to take a moment to look at the consequences of this law, especially after new footage brings a notorious case back into the limelight. It shows police tasing an immigrant to death. Take a look. It's hard to see there because it's dark, but you can hear as a crowd of agents swarmed around Anastasio Hernandez. He's on the ground as the officers continue to tase him. Police earlier said that Hernandez's behavior justified the use of force, but this video brings that all into question. For further discussion on Arizona's immigration law and its consequences, I was joined earlier by author and activist Kevin Powell. He is the author of the book, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, and the Ghost of Dr. King. Here is his take.
Well, the people need to understand, and I've been to Arizona many times, that a lot of folks, particularly the Latino community, has been very affected by this. You know, to feel like every time you step out of your house, be you walking down the street or driving, that you're going to be stopped, and not just stopped summarily, but asked for identification and prove that you're a citizen. I mean, that kind of undermines what it is to be a democratic society. And I think that people need to understand that this is the law that's not just in Arizona, but it's actually spread around the country, most prominently in the last couple of months in the state of Alabama as well. And so this is something that has national implications and definitely is a political issue in this presidential cycle, election cycle.
Now, this now infamous case of Trayvon Martin, the teenager shot dead by a neighborhood watchman, has put this issue of racial profiling back into the spotlight. But does this law make racial profiling legal?
Well, you know, it's debatable. You know, if you ask people in the Latino community or the Black community or other communities, feel that they're constantly under surveillance, absolutely. And it's really not what our country should be about. And I can tell you, as someone myself who's been the victim of racial profiling, it's not a situation that you want to have to live in. And I mean, back to the immigration piece, I just think that Americans need to understand that our country was built on the backs of immigrants. Except for slavery, everyone in this country has come from somewhere else under their own desire to be in this kind of society, this democratic society. And I think it's unfortunate that this is being debated by the highest court in the land, and could potentially affect a lot of people in this country.
Now, the Obama administration is debating this law, or opposing this law, rather, the basis that this conflict between state and federal law. But is the issue really racial and ethnic discrimination?
Well, I think that the issue is, do we believe in the rights of people to immigrate to this country who are...
And keep your hands to yourself.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the last half an hour of the Friday show. We are broadcasting live from the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. You can find our website at reasonradionetwork.com. I'm Mike Connor. I'm joined tonight by co-host Matt Parrott. We're accepting call-ins, 1-855-477-2283. And we have, to finish up a show, a few news items. And the first one is entitled, Maine named the most peaceful state in America. Maine is the most peaceful state in America, and Louisiana the least, according to rankings by an Australian think tank called the Institute for Economics and Peace. The rankings are based on the prevalence of violent crimes, homicides, police employees, size of the prison population, and small arms availability. Overall, 2011 was the most peaceful year in the United States. The United States has experienced in 20 years. Homicides and violent crimes both dropped by more than 3% last year, while the murder rate has plummeted to a staggering 50% since 1991. Well, there's reasons for that I'll get into. But when the survey first started, however, prison violence, which is not counted in the report, has risen dramatically as the number of people behind bars has also grown. Well, that explains the drop in homicide. If you lock up a large amount of a population, they can't commit crimes as easily.
Well, and there's also the advances in DNA testing and the ubiquity of security cameras, the forensics and stuff like that. It is harder to get away with crime than it used to be, and that's not lost on criminals. So I think some of that's more the police state stuff that's been imposed, in addition to, of course, throwing them all behind bars.
Yeah, there's definite reasons why the crime rate has dropped. Now, another thing this article says is that almost half of all forcible rapes occur in prison. And since I think the prisoner population is about 90% male, and I'm not sure that women rape each other if they're in sexually segregated prison institutions. By saying that almost half of all forcible rapes occur in prison, you're saying that almost the majority of rapes are probably man on man, which is a pretty disgusting thought. Not that any rape is good, but we have this gigantic prison industry, which is beyond the scope of actually the Third Reich in its early days, when they threw a few communists in the pen for who were incorrigible. But the article goes on to say that Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Minnesota, and Utah were the top five most peaceful states. Louisiana was the least peaceful, followed by Tennessee, Nevada, Florida, and Arizona. And it turns out that is actually what's interesting. Three of the top five states are the ones from northern New England. I actually lived in Vermont for a few years, and it is it's kind of a holdover when most of New England was largely Anglo-Saxon. Connecticut now has quite a bit of different white ethnic groups in it, but Vermont is still pretty. It's pretty much old stock America, and they have their interesting culture. But there's another article. This is actually this article goes back to 2009, but this was published in an Indian periodical called the I think it's Indian Bangor Daily News. Where is Bangor? Is that in India? Or I believe it's in India. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But according to this, the updated U.S. Census figures released today show that Maine is the whitest and oldest state in the nation. Two trends that have significant policy implications. Yeah, it also has significant crime implications. Maine
you're
is the whitest.
Bangalore.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Bangor's in Maine.
Bangor, Maine. I'm thinking of Bangalore. Oh gosh, boy, let's leave that in. I need my humility treatment once a week. Okay, actually, we do have a caller, Michael. I'm going to add him to the call. Good, I'm saved by the bell. Michael from South Carolina, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
What is your question?
Well, I just wanted to comment on this last story that y'all had talked about as far as the violence in the various states. And I know that it looks bad in the southern states, And I just wanted to point out that it really depends on where you are. It depends on, most of these counties are overwhelmingly white or overwhelmingly black, and very few, I would say, are kind of a even mixture. And so if you're in an overwhelmingly white county, there's probably very little crime. Like where I live, there's very little crime. I live kind of on the outskirts of a mostly white county. So it just really depends. I think that, you know, these statistics, just like the statistics on as far as the students and their performance and so forth in the schools, kind of they're slanted against the South because of the racial demographics here.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you see that in even where I'm from in Connecticut, we don't have large metropolises like some of the other states do. Like Maryland has Baltimore and Philadelphia. When there's Philadelphia and there's, you know, St. Louis. But even in the smaller towns in Connecticut, you know, even in the town I live, which is Waterbury, which is, you know, only got about 200,000 people, you know, it's almost neighborhood by neighborhood. You know, things, you know, one street over makes a difference on the crime rate. It's kind of weird that people kind of stay right in their own locations. And so, you know, we definitely have a racial correlation between crime rates. And, you know, one thing I want to mention is you have relatively poor states like Kentucky and up to recently, North Dakota wasn't one of the richest states. And they also have, you know, pretty, or I should say not Kentucky, West Virginia is a good example of a state that's relatively poor and all white. And we see that the racial correlation trumps the income correlation time and again. So I'm glad you made that point. And that's certainly true that it doesn't, you know, there's nothing against a state for having a high crime rate. It's just that it's the number of non-whites in it, and particularly the non-Asian non-whites.
I would also say, I mean, it's not just bad people. Also, you know, like, for example, Mississippi is the poorest state in the United States, but per capita, they give the most to charity in Mississippi, you know. So it's not bad people. I mean, it's good people. It's just, you know, you're dealing with the people, you know, as they are.
Yep, that's, I mean, it goes along with, you know, what we were saying earlier about Trayvon Martin and whatnot. And, this is something that's very poorly related. And, you know, I made probably the biggest gaffe I've made since I've started this program with Matt. You know, I didn't realize, I forgot, I was just had a brain lapse, and I thought this paper was in another country. But the reason why I thought that is because, you know, a lot of times you don't get on any such thing honest regarding the race in the mainstream media. So that's the reason I made that mistake, I think. Do you have anything else to add to the show?
No, I appreciate it and enjoy y'all's show.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for your call. So, Matt, should we move on to another article? Let's rapid fire through them. Okay, and the next one is from the Daily Mail in UK, which is a tabloid, which I'm familiar with, and I know a country it's in. And this is actually not always a terrible tabloid because they've reported some articles relatively honestly, but this one really gets under my skin. The title of the article is "Restaurant Racism Revealed as 40% of Waiters Admit They Discriminate Against Black Customers Because, quote-unquote, they don't tip well." Most people would like to believe that racial discrimination, according to the article, is becoming increasingly rare and unacceptable in mainstream society, but a new study suggests that African Americans still face subtle prejudice in at least one area of life, dining out. A survey of waiters in North Carolina revealed that nearly two-fifths admitted to treating customers differently depending on race, and as many as 90% said they had participated in or overheard racially charged conversations among their co-workers. So, Matt, white waiters are to blame for blacks being poor tippers is the takeaway from this article.
Oh, well, the restaurant industry actually did a large and elaborate study on ethnic differences in tipping and found that, indeed, when the other environmental variables are controlled, gentlemen of color, ladies and gentlemen of color, don't tip as well. And, you know, these people, it's so funny that these rich white people are so concerned about finger quote, racism of these whites who these waiters and wait staff who are barely surviving in this economy, and they're worried about whether they might be unfairly discriminating against one family and how long they take to get their beverages refilled. Yeah, it's preposterous. It's silly. It's, you know, it's motivated by hate to be that quick to jump on and judge somebody in that situation. I mean, I guarantee you, if blacks tipped well or probably even on par, they would serve them just as readily. It's the business is too aggressive. The margin of error is too narrow, and these people, their ability to pay their rent or buy their groceries is on the line, and they have to make tough choices.
Yeah, I've talked to numerous people who have worked in the restaurant industry as wait staff and bartenders and whatnot, and it's pretty much a unanimous picture. Years ago, I was with I worked for a company, and we would go to breakfast every morning. It was a construction company one particular summer, and we went to this one restaurant. You get to know the waitress and everything, and she would complain to us, not all the time, but, on one or two occasions, like she mentioned, there'd be a couple of black women sitting in a booth for like 2 hours in her space. So obviously she makes money by how fast the booths turn over. And they wanted their coffee filled a million times, and they don't leave a tip. So, it kills her income for that day. And that's just one anecdote, and that doesn't prove anything. But I've heard it enough that it's just basically statistically true. And blacks also like to make whites run, and they complain a lot, despite the fact they don't tip. I tend to be the opposite. Most whites tend to be. You kind of see that, the restaurant's busy and the waiter or waitress doesn't get back quick enough. You kind of give a break and don't hold it against them. And, unless they're being deliberately, if they're deliberately or they're really egregiously poor servers, then, yeah, you might take it then, or you might regard them as bad servers then. But this is just another example of the overall narrative that whenever there's a problem with blacks, it's the white person's fault. Now, you picked out another article, and I would like to mention this one. Apparently, this article is about seeking justice for Haiti's rape victims. And they give an anecdote of a rape victim. 3 days after a massive earthquake threw Haiti into chaos, Elvana was homeless along with her two children, but her nightmare was just beginning. Quote, "I was gang raped while I was sleeping in the middle of the street," she said, "and I got pregnant." Elvana did not know her attackers, depressed and unsure of what to do next. She was directed by a friend to a clinic run by some organization called COFA VIV, a cruel acronym that translates into the Commission of Women and Victims for Victims. And Matt, is there any way that we could pin this problem of women being raped in the aftermath of a national disaster on white racism or white people?
Oh, well, absolutely. The white response to the earthquake in Haiti was not nearly it did two opposite things wrong. It both imposed on the Haitian people. These aid groups came in and they thought they were gonna, run Haiti while they were there, and they offended the Haitian people by imposing themselves the way they did, and they didn't do enough. So, it's just a terrible thing that the whites did to the Haitian people. You know, on first analysis, you're probably thinking, well, you know, an earthquake struck. How's that our fault? But, you know, I think once you look a little more closely, once you realize that the Haitian people themselves can't possibly be held accountable in any way, shape, or form. Well, the CNN article, it's funny. It sort of makes it like, well, you know, the earthquake caused the Haitian people to trip, fall, and rape some people. Like that's an excuse. Like when an earthquake happens in Japan or in any sensible country, that you would have a similar phenomenon. And I would be interested to know how many rapes occurred in the wake of the terrible Japanese tsunami.
Yeah, I was going to just bring that up. Yeah. You know, I didn't hear about any gang rapes in Japan after their disaster, tsunami. I don't know of it. You know, I don't know of any white on white gang rapes in the aftermath of Katrina or when the Mississippi flooded the other year.
Oh yeah, the Midwest flooding. You know, that was huge. The flooding happened, and everybody was just running around gang raping women in the street. It was madness here in Indiana. Yeah.
But that wouldn't be
ridiculous.
Was it black racism that caused that, or was it?
That is also white racism. I think that's, well, there's no such thing as black racism.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah, there's only white racism.
So, all right, let's move on. Let's move on to the next article. Well, here's one I'm going to mention because it's a follow-up to something I think we talked about last week. And Ted Nugent is going to be investigated for his comments on Obama by the Secret Service. And like I said, that's, you know, it's a little bit like joking about bombing a plane. It's not something you want to do at an airport, and you don't want to go out in public and talk about chopping people's heads off in November. Or being in debt or in jail by this time next year if Barack gets elected president again. So I just wanted to say that I'm glad that they're looking into him because it couldn't happen to a nicer chicken hawk. And I don't really care about this guy. And
well, anybody explain to him that Barack Obama is actually like a huge warmonger who's engaged in more wars than Bush? I mean, how much war does Ted Nugent need to satisfy his craving for more war?
I don't know. I wish these people
must
would
be
just
a lot
play
of
video
war.
Games. it's part of the preposterousness of these people who play into this two-party shell game. I mean, the differences between the two parties are largely superficial and contained and kind of just used to try to make a show of democracy, and it's part of the controlling mechanism. But yeah, but the fact is that he is a bloodthirsty maniac who wants to see more wars and more people killed and more young American boys with their legs blown off and other appendages
not
blown
himself,
off.
Of course.
Not
other,
himself, of course.
Other
no,
Americans.
he's willing to soil
pants.
Himself. Yeah, he's gonna not just literally, literally crap his pants, I should say. So I hope that hope he gets the whole full cavity search when he gets questioned by the Secret Service because he definitely deserves it. Okay. Next article. Lesbian scout leader ousted in Ohio, and according to the article, parents are upset. And I want to mention the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts of America. It's an organization which has somewhat held the line as having some sort of remotely sensible principles. The first graders in Ohio Pack 109 Tiger Scouts didn't know or care that Denmark was a lesbian, at least not until the Boy Scouts of America threw her out of the organization based on their ban of what they call gays, homosexuals. Now, parents who were aware of Jennifer Tyrell's sexual orientation well before she took the boys on campouts and helped them carve race cars for the annual Pinewood Derby have rallied to her defense in a case that's reignited the debate over the Scouts' policy. This is an interesting thing to me because this is one of the few national level organizations that has managed to withstand the sort of attacks by the homosexuals who they want to force everyone to associate with open homosexuals. And it'll be interesting to see if they finally cave in, because, you know, they keep trying until eventually people cave. And the Boy Scout. Yeah, well, they haven't so far. And I know this has been tried several times over the years. The Boy Scouts of America, whose oath calls for members to be morally straight, quote unquote, maintains that as a private organization has the right to exclude gays and atheists from its ranks. So.
For now. Or they'll find some legal angle. You know, these Boy Scout events do occur on public property, and they often drive on city roads and across geographical, you know, political boundaries on the way to campouts, and therefore it's, it's illegal for them to discriminate because it's on state parks or whatever. They can't win, and they won't win, and they are the last holdouts, and I think they've behaved honorably, but they won't win.
Well, you're a little bit fatalist there. I was hoping I was hoping for a little bit more of rah-rah or something on this little issue.
not tonight. Tonight.
I guess not. Well, you know, something that we covered, just as another example of the sort of campaign against the traditional family, which is well underway. This is a little bit old news, but Democratic strategist Hillary Rosen was eventually forced to apologize for saying of Ann Romney, and nobody please take this as an endorsement of Mitt Romney, the presidential candidate. But anyway, Mitt Romney's wife, Ann Romney, according to Hillary Rosen, she never worked a day in her life. And despite the fact that she's raised five children and she's been a housewife and a good mother from everything we know. And what happened was this was a step too far. And Hillary Rosen was forced to apologize, but she gave a kind of convoluted.
It was a not apology. It was a total not apology. What I find amusing about this is after it happened, it was totally like a manufactured thing. Like the Democrats all got together and like, let's frame Romney as anti-woman. That'll be a good wedge thing. That's good, like back and forth puppet politics. And this Rosen woman totally ruined it for the Democratic side by being wide open, just insulting stay-at-home moms. Directly and viciously, she stepped over the line, and then the liberal media was all like, well, this is all just this whole war on moms thing is silly. Let's move on to something else. Like, wait, no, you're the ones who invented this. Like, you know, we just made that whole thing up. Let's see, what's that over there? Is there something shiny moving over there?
Yeah, that was what she was forced to do. She had a moment of candor, which these Jewish feminists are usually somewhat on guard with, especially as a Democratic strategist and therefore somewhat of a spokesperson for the Democratic Party. She definitely made a misstep, but it does show the sort of axe grindingness of these Jewish feminists and their complete contempt of
Christians at home, especially homeschoolers. I do want to. I know we're coming up close to the break, and you might not be prepared for this, but I do want to mention a tragedy that happened for the entire movement, for pro-whiteness and for tradition, for our side, and that's the passing. A few weeks ago, we all just found out about this week. Of Jonathan Bowden.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the chat, I believe yesterday, and I was really, really taken aback by that because he was only 49 years old, and he was such an effective speaker, and people would rave about him, actually. And
well, I was blessed to get to meet him just a few weeks before he passed. I got to spend some quality time with him.
Yeah, I did, and I really regret that I didn't talk to him more. Does anybody know the reason for the delay between finding out? I guess that
I don't wish to speculate on open radio, but I think his family is not
in
tune with the movement.
That was part of the thing that just puzzled me, though. But I was really saddened by it. And so let's remember Jonathan Bowden.
Absolutely.
Thank you, folks. We'll be back next week with another show.
Life is a struggle and it's changing through.